Let's call them Karen and Chris. They're 20. They're in college. They're American. They're Jews. And they're incredibly smug and complacent about the ancient prejudices of men. They believe that racism, anti-Semitism, these belong to the past. They can be found, of course, not in the brave new world of consciousness three of the post-Christian society of the secular age, but among the soft-headed and the hard-hatted and the high-privileged, that it's only a matter of time before the new generation succeeds the old, before the new hope takes over from the ancient hates, before a brave new world emerges. Now, Karen and Chris, 20, American, Jewish, bright. But they are incredibly innocent of history, incredibly ignorant of the facts of life today. For the sad truth of it is that among those who claim to be the disciples of the most advanced ideologies, among those governments which pride themselves about being revolutionary, the tide of a new world, precisely here we are seeing the deliberate use, once again, by governments, by authorities, by men who know better, the deliberate manipulation of the most ancient hates of the race. The Jew is again becoming the whipping boy and the scapegoat for the assorted ills of mankind. And it is not only among the aging, among the privileged, among the ignorant, precisely among the advanced, the so-called liberated, the so-called free thinking, that these ancient prejudices are being revived. Out of Algeria comes the word to the Black Panthers, to the other black militant groups, that racism is really a form of Zionist imperialism, and that the Jew is the consummate, the ultimate whitey. Out of the People's Republic of Poland comes evidence. The Polish press has explained to its own people the rebellions of the last weeks against agricultural failure and higher food prices by claiming that the dock workers and the mine workers who struck, protested, revolted were in fact dupes of an international Zionist conspiracy. Out of the underground press of the Weathermen has come the word to the brothers and sisters that one must beware even of those in the ranks who are of Jewish background because they are somehow congenitally bourgeois. And out of Moscow has come the word that there must be a show trial, not for the theft of a plane by men and women seeking asylum outside the Soviet Union's borders, the trial, a show trial for treason, treason against the Soviet state. And the propaganda mills of Trud and Pravda, all the propaganda agencies of the Soviet Union have made it very clear throughout the length and breadth of that vast country that the treason charge is a deliberate one and a fit one, that it describes those Jews on trial. because they and their like other Jewish trials are pending, are the alien, are the subversive, are those who are undermining the strength of the Soviet peoples. There are, unfortunately, despite the high romantic hopes of some of our young, no radical discontinuities in history. Being children of hope, men have always looked to a brand new, bright tomorrow. Tomorrow is woven of the stuff of yesterday. Two generations ago, another group of young people looked to a brave new world, freed of the ancient hates. And again, it was in the Soviet and about the Soviet that these hopes were centered. Russia had been a land of immemorial anti-Semitic prejudice. The Jewish problem was the old problem and the basic problem, and Jewish hate had been sponsored by the Tsarist governments. The Communist Party came to power, and in its promise was implicit the statement that anti-Semitism was part of the mechanisms by which Tsarist tyrannical governments ruled, that it would be outlawed in the New World. And Jews were attracted by that promise, and for the first few years, it seemed that the promise might indeed be true. Anti-Semitism was proscribed as a crime by the Soviet Constitution, and many Jews, those who had given up their faith, who could belong to the Communist Party, found that they could rise into the Comintern and the Cominform high in the Communist Party and assume positions of authority within the state. Here was the brave new world. It would come in the attack against privilege and attack against the citadels of ancient hate. But soon, Stalin broke with Trotsky and broke Trotsky, and Trotsky was the Jew. And soon there were the purge trials of the 30s, and who was purged? Primarily the Jew. And suddenly the old Jewish Bolshevik looked around himself, and though he hardly would admit it, there were no old Jewish Bolsheviks in the higher ranks of the Communist Party any longer. There was an interruption for the war, but after the war, those Jewish veterans in the Ukraine who returned to reclaim, as was their right, their homes, their apartments, found that Mr. Khrushchev, who was the commissar of the Ukraine, had told the Ukrainians that these only belonged to Jews, that they could be theirs permanently. And soon Stalin held the infamous doctor's trial in which the Soviet claimed that there was, through the agency of these men, an international Jewish conspiracy to poison the leaders of the Soviet Union. And soon there were in the economic trials, Mr. Khrushchev made it very clear through the Soviet press that these were designed against the Jew. The Jewish defendants were those who were publicized, and they were always publicized in a way that would underscore the Jewishness of their person. Their names were always Isaac ben Moshe instead of Isaac Mosevich. And now we come to the last few years. The Soviet Union has made itself one of the publication centers for anti-Semitic material as old as the Tsarist protocols of the Elders of Zion. And the Soviet Union has made itself not only into the enemy of Israel, but into an agency which proclaims daily through its press to all who will listen in the world. The world is in the hands of the Jewish media, the Jewish merchant and the Jewish banker, and if it were not for our insidious presence, there could be peace and fraternity and openness among all the children of men. Unfortunately, there are no radical discontinuities in history. Unfortunately, the ancient hates appear and reappear on the left and on the right and in many guises and many forms. They are somehow part of the wharf and woof of that which goes to make up what we call Western civilization. And for any who would have doubts, for any who think that the only issue of the protests of the last 2 weeks was a desperate attempt to save the lives of two men who had been sentenced to the firing squad, let them note that the Soviet response, the pressure, not to Jewish pressure, but the pressure from the Third World, pressure from some of its own communist parties who sensed the smell of viciousness and the smell of entrapment in these Star Chamber proceedings. The first response of the Soviet was an ugly one, an angry one. Let no one feel that the Zhij, the Jew, has somehow forced us to rescind, to commute these sentences. Not at all. Let the world recognize that the Jew is the troublemaker. Were it not for Israel, there could be peace. Were it not for the Jew in the United States and in the world, the free so-called Western world, and we would have no issues between you. You are all being manipulated by the Jew. How much are you willing to put up with? How much? Are you willing to put up with the attack upon your embassies, upon the bustling and the elbowing of your counselors? How much indignity, how much pressure will you take until you will recognize that it is unnecessary for us to be at loggerheads? We can talk, but we can't talk when you talk with the mouth of the Jew. Soviet line is very clear. Israel is a fascist, imperialist state. Dayan is a symbol of Israel, and Dayan is always pictured in Soviet cartoons with his eye patch and with a swastika on his shoulder. Israel is fascist, militarist, imperialist, a pig state. Israel is the center of a worldwide conspiracy managed by the international Jewish bodies, financed by the international Jewish bankers, run through and by the international Jewish control of the mass media. We delude the world. We subvert the world. Were it not for this Jewish conspiracy, the peoples of the world would recognize their true identity of interest. Get rid of the Jew. We take the Jew from his position of power. And you will see how quickly we can work together for the common good. And even Judaism is openly attacked in the Soviet today. Nothing is published in the Soviet Union which does not receive an imprimatur, a seal of approval. In the last 8 or 10 years, again, we have seen some of the ugliest kinds of filth and slime published, not only against Israel, but against individual Jews, but against this faith. Men by the name of Trofim Kitschko, Ivan Ivanov, so-called scholars, have spent months and years pulling together all of the canards, all of the lies that have ever been told by Jews, by anyone in the course of history, and publishing these as truth through the official publishing houses of the state. Did you know that Judaism teaches genocide? Do you know that we require the domination of the world for our own purposes? Do you know that we have determined that all non-Jews must bow to our will and to our authority, must be the hewers of wood and the bringers of waters to our homes and to our synagogues? And that our Bible specifically tells us that anyone who will not be subjugated to our authority may be killed without compunction. Did you know that? The Russian people are being taught that by these so-called scholars and these so-called scholarly publications. And so it goes. The ancient hates are being deliberately manipulated, fanned alive into flame. And the Jew, we benighted 13 million, have become again the managers of the world. Would that it were so. If we could manage the world, it might be a better place. But of course, it is not so. Trials that existed in the Soviet in Leningrad 2 weeks ago, court-martial that took place there last week, are the surface symbol of a renewal within the Soviet Union, of a deliberate medieval, but now from the left, attempt to use the Jew as the scapegoat and whipping boy for internal and external pressures. What are we guilty of? When the Soviet Union, we are guilty of subversion. When anyone writes anything within the Soviet, which the Board of Censors does not like, it is Jewish, it is Zionist, it is imperialist, it is Jewish. When those men and women in the Soviet who have the courage to protest the Soviet, take over Czechoslovakia, all this is simply part of a Zionist international conspiracy. Whenever the Soviet wants to silence its writers, it finds a young Jewish writer, that is a young writer who bears the stamp Ivrei, Hebrew, upon his passport. It hauls him up for a state trial as proof of this Zionist conspiracy, as a warning to all other writers to toe the mark. Perhaps a little history here ought to be placed before us. First metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church, the 11th century, published the first anti-Semitic book in Russia. Russia has always been a turned-in, an insular state, fearful particularly of the West, fearful of cosmopolitanism, fearful of those things which we call Western liberal humanism. The Jew was prohibited from dwelling within Muscovy, within the Russian Empire. And those Jews who live within the Soviet today came under Russian rule, not because they were part, because by conquest, because they lived in territories, the Ukraine first, and then Poland in the 18th century, 19th century, which Russia gobbled up and took in unto itself, and then did not know what to do about the undesirable alien. The Jew. The Jewish problem has been part and parcel of Soviet intellectual life, of Russian intellectual life from the very beginning. And if you read the Russian writers of the 19th century, the Turgenevs and the Dostoevskys, you will find stereotypes as anti-Semitic as any that you will find anywhere in the history of Western literature. The Jew is a problem. What is the solution to the Jewish problem? Well, the Tsars had answers. Pobudenestjev, the prime minister of the last Tsar, said, I'll exile one-third of them, I'll starve one-third of them to death, and we'll convert one-third of them. That's his solution to the Jewish problem. The communists began in opposition to the Tsars. All that the Tsars did was evil in the communist mind. And so this original proscription of anti-Semitism. It was seen to be debasing the prejudice, the hate that it is. But then as the Soviet Union grew, as it became more national and less international, as it began to cater to the domestic needs of its own people, their hates, their prejudices, their hopes, it began to take over it more and more of the ancient hates. These were not erased. They were not taught away by communist ideology. They remain very open, and I've tried already to detail how they have surfaced, and how they are now being manipulated within the Soviet. Soviet is then of one act and two minds. The actions are generally anti-Semitic. The mind is at the one hand practical, and in the other ideological. And when it deals with ideology, it must perforce hold anti-Semitism to be a heresy, something it may not use. Therefore, Zionism is the code word for anti-Semitism. And the Zionist is the code symbol of the Jew. The Soviet Union, of course, proscribes all religion. And when Jews have protested that the anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic activities of the Soviet are different in kind than the anti-religious activities of the Soviet against other faiths, the charge is always laid to rest by the statement, it is part of our ideology that we are atheists, we do not promote any religious group. But the point is that in fact, the pressures which have been leveled against the Jew are different in kind and different in quality than those which have been leveled against any other of the faith. The Jews have been made to suffer great indignity. Not only the closing of 900 and some synagogues, not only the closing of the one yeshiva that was in existence, not only the unwillingness of the Soviet to allow Yiddish literature, Yiddish theater, folk music to be freely produced, not only the unwillingness of the Soviet to allow such necessaries as prayer books, as luachs, the date books, to be printed. The fact that the Jewish community is constantly under the gun, senses that it is being pressured. Some years ago, Elie Wiesel went to the Soviet. He said in the preface to the diary he printed at his return, I was drawn to the Soviet Union by the silence of these Jews, and I have brought back their cry. And the cry that he brought back was the cry of the silence he saw within their eyes. The sense that whenever he approached a Jew, he looked over his shoulder, he was fearful of speaking, that even when he went to the synagogue in Moscow and Kiev, he found that there was a little section down front reserved for foreign guests, and that all around that section there were informer Jews to see that he didn't have a chance to speak to the few within the congregation who might have spoken to him. He speaks of walking through the street, and suddenly, furtively, someone will sidle up to him, say, are you a Jew? Yes. Tell them what it's like. And then this man disappears into the shadows. One of the interesting byproducts of history is the partial truth of the communist belief in dialectic materialism. That is, that there is, to every challenge there is a response, to every act there is a riposte. And the Soviet attack upon Jews and upon Jewry has led to a steadiness, a sturdiness among Jews in the Soviet Union we might not have expected otherwise. Because these Jews have been raised without Judaism, without synagogue, without the modernization of their faith. They have been raised with really nothing binding them to their faith except the word Hebrew stamped as a nationality upon their passports. Every day they have read in the Soviet press about the crimes of Israel, the crimes of this international Jewish conspiracy. They are pushed and they are shoved, and increasingly they recognize that they are not allowed in many places of high power, in the diplomatic corps, in the army officer corps, in the role of the high regions of the communist government. And yet somehow, in the last years, on Simchat Torah, in the great synagogues of Moscow and Leningrad and Kiev, young Jews have appeared from all over to dance the night away. They don't know the songs, they don't know the prayers, they know only that they're drawn here somehow by the hatred which they feel, by the label which they must bear, by the existence of the State of Israel, which means something in their lives. And the last 5 years or so, these silent Jews, or some of them, have become not so silent. They were offered by the Soviet in one of these offers made for international consumption more than for domestic action. They were offered the right to petition the government for the right of emigration. There is a bureau within the Soviet called OVIR, which is the Bureau of Passports, Visa, and Emigration. And the Soviet government, because it doesn't want to seem to the third world, to Latin America, to be the police state it is, published to the world the fact that any who wanted could go to these bureaus and could apply for the right of emigration. And lo and behold, Jews went to these bureaus and applied for the right of emigration. Not a Jew, not 10 Jews, but 100 Jews, 1,000 Jews, 10,000 Jews, we don't know how many. And the Soviet Union was somewhat startled by this response. It didn't mean for anybody to take up this offer. It had seen to it that no one would take up the offer because it had made very clear that once you apply for emigration, you lose your job, you lose your right to live in your apartment, you lose any medical health rights under the state, and your children will be denied further matriculation at any school. But the Jews came. They wanted to get out. They were willing to accept the danger. What was the Soviet to do? No. 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 What was the Jew to do? They began to write letters. Letters to the Bureau, letters to Kosygin and Brezhnev, and they sent copies of these letters. Uthant, United Nations Commission on Human Rights, to the President of the United States, the President of Israel. And they signed their names to these letters. At what cost? With what danger? All the Jews who were tried in Leningrad 2 weeks ago came from one group in Riga, in Latvia, who had written one such letter and allowed a copy of it to be smuggled to the West where it was published. No wonder they were tried, perhaps entrapped. What did the Jews say? We want out. A group of 18 very traditional heads of families in Georgia, southern Russia, sent a year ago, a letter which ended in this way. History has placed a great mission on the United Nations organization to think about people and to help them. Therefore, we demand the United Nations Commission for the Rights of Man should take all the measures that it can, and in the shortest possible time should obtain from the government of the USSR the permit for our emigration. It is incomprehensible that at the end of the 20th century, it should be possible to forbid people to live wherever they wish. It is strange how one can forget the widely broadcast appeals concerning the rights of nations for self-determination, and naturally the right of men, out of whom nations are composed. We shall wait for months and for years, if necessary, for our entire life, but we shall not renounce our faith and our hope. We believe our prayers have reached God. We know our appeals will reach men. Because we do not ask for much, let us go to the land of our ancestors. No. Their lives endangered. The Soviet Union began to publish in its press letters to the editor, forgeries of men and women who presumably had gone to Israel and returned because they had found in Israel a class-ridden society, a vicious society, a venal society, ugliness, hate, a police state. Still they came, at all costs. One such man, an engineer named Drabkin from Moscow, wrote this letter, which he addressed to Kosygin as chairman of the Council of Ministers of the USSR, which he sent out, smuggled out, to be published in the West. He, of course, knew it would not be acted on. My case is as follows. My wife and I have repeatedly applied to the Soviet authorities with a request to permit us to emigrate to Israel, to our relatives from whom we have become separated as a result of the war. The emigration permit has been refused to us. All letters sent by me to the leaders of the Soviet government were sent to the OVIR, to the Ministry of Interior, which simply informs the petitioner orally by phone of the refusal to grant the immigration permit. After my wife and I have applied with a request for permission to emigrate to Israel, repressive measures were undertaken against us. I have been dismissed from my job, and now my wife is being dismissed. We worked as scientific workers. This field of activity has now become closed to us. The director of institutions where we work told us repeatedly that we as persons wishing to go to a capitalist state cannot be entrusted with work of research nature. Therefore, the education and experience attained by us have become valueless. In effect, we have become a necessary people in the USSR. Our desire to go to the Jewish state comes from our national convictions and a desire to unite with our relatives in Israel, and not from any hostility for the USSR. I would draw your attention to the fact that the attaching of people to the land was repealed in Russia in 1861. Before the repeal of the right of serfdom, that is, of the legally established order in accordance with which people were not allowed to leave the territory in which they lived, they had been able to ransom themselves out, or they could be ransomed by somebody else. Now, however, my wife and I and our child are deprived even of this elemental right. I hope that you will take into consideration that a forcible keeping of Jews wishing to go to their relatives in Israel cannot be an embellishment to the history of any country, including the USSR, which has proclaimed the lofty ideals of mankind, and on and on. No. Still they came. Driven by what? Marginal status? Campaign of hate? The toleration of individual acts of open anti-Semitic contempt? The recognition that promotion is denied them because they are Jews? The recognition that there is no long-range hope for their children in this land, and that their children must always bear on their passports, whatever their fate, the word Hebrew? What is the real state of life within the Soviet? A year ago, with incredible courage, 26 members of the Jewish intelligentsia in Lithuania, all affiliated with the Lithuanian party, wrote a letter in Vilnius, one of the cities of Lithuania, describing their plight. They sent it to the West also. They signed it. They've not been heard from since. It's worth listening to. They wrote it to be read. We communists and non-party representatives of the Jewish intelligentsia, who have discussed and signed this document, are addressing ourselves to the Central Committee of the Lithuanian Communist Party because of our great anxiety about the rising wave of anti-Semitism in Soviet Lithuania. We draw the attention of the Central Committee to the fact that in the places of mass murder, where tens of thousands of Jews are buried, no memorials have been built, although a monument has been erected at Prikipus to commemorate 100 innocent Lithuanians who were murdered there. We draw the attention of the Central Committee to the fact that 25,000 Jews living in Soviet Lithuania have not forgotten who carried out these mass murders. We realize that the anti-Israel propaganda conducted by the Soviet press is not destined for internal consumption and is not directed at Jews who live in the Soviet Union. But it should not be overlooked that despite all stylistic nuances, anti-Israel propaganda, and especially the cartoons of the Central Press, have revived anti-Semitic passions in a certain section of the Lithuanian, and not only the Lithuanian nation. We cannot be silent when the press publishes materials which encourages local Judaphobia. The weekly Vilnius Speaks published quotations selected by an ethnologist, Saint Skrodenis, which he culled from Lithuanian classical literature, depicting Jews as a traditional object of mockery. The writings cited are full of anti-Russian and anti-Polish sentiments that might as easily have been assembled. But the ethnologist and the editors knew that it is not permitted nowadays to mock a drunken Russian bureaucrat or an honorable Polish landowner, whereby there is no difficulty nowadays in so writing about Jews. Only this might explain the painstaking ethnographic selections. The vice chairman of the television committee, Kuliesis, at a meeting openly attacked one of the TV contributors because of his supposed Jewish mannerisms and gesticulations on the screen. The president of the teachers' training college told the Jewish instructor, quote, "Today it is not important if you excel others in German or English languages, in physics or mathematics, chemistry or music. We must train our own cadres so that tomorrow's Lithuanians will be more qualified than you." All this man was doing was to give public expression to a principle that has long been practiced in cadre policy. Here are the facts. During the entire post-war period, not a single Jewish student living in Lithuania received a state scholarship to continue his studies at higher institutions in Moscow or Leningrad. Not a single Jew from Lithuania has taken postgraduate education in Moscow or Leningrad. No Jewish communist, apart from one, has attended the Academy of Social Sciences of the Soviet Communist Party Central Committee. 10% of the inhabitants of Vilnius are Jews. But so far, not a single Jew has been elected chairman, deputy chairman, or secretary of the city, or of any of its four regional executive committees. No Jew has been elected judge of a people's court. No Jew has been elected to a senior post in the trade union administration. No representative of Jewish youth has ever been given a leading post in party or trade union work. We do not wish to depict the situation in Lithuania in two black colors. We know very well, and this is interesting, we know very well that the situation of Jews in Lithuania is considerably better than in other parts of the USSR, especially in the Ukraine, where the persecution of our people is particularly terrible. And here's the proof of that statement. During the entire post-war period, there has been only one bloody pogrom in Lithuania, whereas in the same period, at least 20 pogroms have occurred in the Ukraine. And on and on. These are the facts. What's for it then? To the Karens and to the Chrises, to the young, they admit these facts. The simple answer is one of demonstration, continued demonstration. But life, unfortunately, is not that simple. What are the solutions for the 3.5 million Jews of the Soviet? Some of these Jews want out, desperately, to be reunited with their families. Many were left in the Soviet Union when the tide of the war began to turn. Their families survived, some of them in the West, and they were left in the East. They want to be reunited. Parents with children, brothers with sisters. Some of them want to leave the Soviet Union because they find conditions within the Soviet intolerable. They're even willing to risk death, to steal a plane, to fly to questionable sanctity and asylum in Finland. Other Jews want in. This is now the third generation of young Jews who has been raised as in communist schools, who've been indoctrinated to look upon religion as the opiate of the masses and Judaism as the most abject of all the religions. They want only to be Russian, to be communist. But they have that word stamped on their passport. And it is a yoke that shackles to them. Those who want to get out cannot get out. Those who want to get in are not allowed in. And probably most of the Jews are confused. They'd like to have something more of their national culture, and national culture by Russian ideology is to be promoted. They'd like to be able to speak Yiddish, to see some Yiddish theater, to have a Yiddish press. They'd like to be able to read Achad Ha'am and Shalom Aleichem. They'd like to have a sense of community. Occasionally, some of them want to go to the synagogue. Some of them want to go more regularly. They'd like to have some books. They'd like to have what makes for ethnic life. But now, today, all that is Jewish is suspect, as Zionist. Judaism begins on principles so radically at variance from the tyrannical, state-oriented, duty-oriented principles of dialectic materialism. The Soviet is hard put ever to allow this. Jews of the Soviet are caught. Caught as Jews have been in all ages by the ugliness of history. Caught as all men really are by the uncertainties of history. One of the most innocent and most romantic of the beliefs of modern man is that we can take life, governments, policies, and reshape that life, the history of our globe, to suit ourselves. We like to think of ourselves as masters of our destiny. Can Israel force peace in the Middle East? Can America force integration in our cities? Can the Jews in the Soviet Union force the Soviet government to grant them a certain minimal security? There are so many things which we cannot bend to our will. Even when we have power, how much the more so when we are powerless. Fortunately, there are no radical disconnects, discontinuities in history. Men retain because they are trained in them, because the literature reinforces them. Men are trained in the ancient zeitgeist, outlook, prejudicial and hopeful of their people. And so there must be demonstration, of course. We must keep before the world the truth of what the Soviet is doing, which begins with a form of cultural genocide, and hopefully will not end with an actual physical attack on its communities. Whenever there is a chance to make clear to the world, as we had 2 weeks ago, that the nature of Soviet activity, we must do so, and do so forcefully. We must be very clear that though men of goodwill throughout the world rallied this time to our side, they may not rally a next time. That there is a diabolic fitness understanding by the Soviets to this current attack upon American diplomats, upon American interests. They do know that there is in the West a group of men and women who also have been trained to share these anti-Semitic attitudes, or they are more latent, who will take the needs, the concerns of the Jew for so long. But if it is the Jew that stands between arms limitation treaties signed between the United States and the Soviet, and the treaty, how long will Washington raise its voice? If it is Israel that stands between peace in Vietnam or peace in the Middle East and Israel alone, how long will those in the West who are in power listen to humanity, the cries of people? How quickly men can turn their ears off if they wish to do so? How much of this pressure will there be? How many in the West will agree that the latent anti-Semites of the West ought to unite because we have nothing to lose but the New York Times? Let us take from the Jew the control, assumed, unreal, but the controls that he has. Let us get on with the business of running this world. Alienation, diaspora, galut, the sense that we stand on insecure grounds, that we are not masters of our fate, that we must ultimately turn to the guardian of Israel, neither slumbers nor sleep, that we must do all that we can in our behalf with principle, with courage, and then hope that God will turn in his mercy towards us and help us to survive. There are no quick, easy solutions to lay before you. All human problems do not have solutions. That's the dangerous idealism of the West. All we can do is try and live. Live with conviction, live with dignity, live hopefully without returning hate for hate. Dare to live with courage. Pray from the depths of our lives and the depths of our being to God. And pray that he will answer us with great enlargement. Karen and Chris are 20. They're filled with the high hopes of the youth. God bless these hopes when they lend greater energy to the noble causes of men. May they and we be united. and the common recognition that man is both a human being and a human brute. That he's both child of the jungle and child of the heavens. That our history cannot be shucked. The ancient ways of men can be modified, but not completely put aside. The world in which we live in is not a hapless world, but not a utopian world. That the generation gap is an emptiness and not a solution to any human problem. Mina Metzar Karati Ya, out of the depths we call again unto the Lord. Though we are modern, we call with the same sense of insufficiency as did our ancestors. Though we are children of a scientific age, we know that science alone is not our salvation. We cannot simply program deliverance. May God answer us as he answered our fathers with a goodly measure of deliverance. Amen.